Hi, everyone. I'm Celia Keenan-Bolger, and this is Sunday Pancakes, a podcast to nourish your head and heart. Welcome to the first episode. I am so excited that you're here and really eager to share the conversations that I've been having with all of these amazing artists. Before the pandemic hit, I had been wrestling with some real questions about my ambition and self-worth. And I just finished a year run of To Kill a Mockingbird on Broadway, which was this dream job with an incredible group of people. I won a Tony Award, there were fancy backstage guests, and I was the lead in the biggest Broadway hit of the season. So from the outside, my life looked pretty great. The inside picture, however, was a little different. I was experiencing a kind of exhaustion that was completely foreign to me. And I started to have this persistent voice deep in my gut that kept asking, "What is wrong with you? You have everything that you wanted. You are living the dream. And yet most of what you're feeling is lonely and tired." And then on top of that, ashamed because I wasn't loving every minute of this moment in my life. And there was this one day towards the end of the run before a Saturday matinee where right before the curtain went up, I started to cry, like hard. And I had the experience of looking at the newspaper prop in my hand and saying the lines, but the whole experience of it was just completely outside of myself. And as the show went on, I was hit with these waves of nausea and lightheadedness. And there's this one scene where we went to look in Boo Radley's window, and I had this overwhelming sense that I was going to pass out in the middle of the Schubert Theater stage. And I somehow made it through the show and called out of the evening performance, which made me feel terrible. But as I got home and explained everything that happened to my husband, as I was retelling it, I said to him, "Do you think I just had a panic attack on stage?" And I have turned that experience over so many times since it happened with a sort of wonder and shame and curiosity. And so I cannot tell you how helpful it was to connect with this week's guest, Danae Benton. She's a Tony-nominated actress for her role in Natasha Pierre and The Great Comet of 1812. She has starred in The Book of Mormon and Hamilton. She has a movie coming out this January, and she was a series regular on the TV show Unreal. But the main reason that I wanted to sit down with Danae was because I first saw her perform at a Broadway Advocacy Coalition event that was in like 2016. And I was immediately struck by the fact that this young performer was spending her Sunday evening right before her Broadway debut in the middle of press week, which is like the most stressful time of previews, at a social justice event. I was also struck by this warmth and ease and self-confidence that she emanated, not only on stage, but off. And we just started working together on this new HBO show called The Gilded Age. And, you know, the first table read, there are all of these creative people swirling around and everybody's going up to each other and introducing themselves and saying hello. And we just sort of parked ourselves at a table and had this really quiet, thoughtful talk. And then it had to end because we had to get to work. But I kept thinking, I want more of that. So I feel so incredibly grateful to have her here as my very first guest on this podcast. Danae, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for all of those kind words. That is so lovely to hear. You never know what people's perspectives of you are, you know? But I am well.
Good. I mean, I feel like I'm COVID good right now.
Yeah. I mean, I think that we're all just carrying like collective grief all of the time. And some days you're drowning in it, and some days you're like, I'm okay today. Some days when I'm just like having a bad day for no reason, I'll like look at my husband and be like, how long am I allowed to say we're surviving a global pandemic and the world is crumbling, so I feel sad today? Because it keeps being true.
And I think inside of all of that sadness, like I feel like these themes of my life that I have always sort of grappled with, that I was faced with some of them so profoundly in the last year. And one of them was this idea, I guess, of self-motivation. And I think as an actor, you know, you're always, particularly in unemployment, you're like, I know I have, there are certain things that I have to do to give structure to the day or to feel like a purposeful human being. And for whatever reason, this past year, that part of my life has felt particularly hard to just motivate.
I can think of like a few reasons as to why.
Have you shared, I mean, how has that come up for you, or has it come up for you before this?
Yeah, I feel like I have a particular journey with that, in that the fact that this pandemic hit this year and affected our lives in the way that we had to shut down, for me, was actually good timing. Like, I think there are other years in my life where this would have completely ruined my sense of stability. But so much of my therapy work over the last 4 or 5 years has been learning how to relate to my perfectionism and only feeling worthy if I'm producing, and that kind of concept of, well, if you're not up before 9, then you've wasted your life and your day, and that kind of neuroses of control. And I think that being a, you know, like a good student, and the structure of school was good for me. And then when I graduated and was on tour, and I was like, I have 8 hours before I have to be anywhere. Like, what am I supposed to do?
Yes.
No one's giving me a gold star. Like, you know, and I think I was really slapped in the face with that. And then I think part two of that, my time on Broadway, my 2 times on Broadway, my body completely crumbled both times. And I had to face the fact that I wasn't a robot for the first time in my life, which I hated having to face that. And it changed me in really meaningful and profound ways that I feel thankful for now, because I think the standard I had for myself was not sustainable. And my body said F you to it. And I'm so thankful that she did, because for so many reasons, for health and sustainability and, you know, healing. But then when this pandemic hit, and some of my friends who were still in the kind of like toxic grind culture were like hit in the face with being stuck with themselves, I felt like the universe had kind of prepared me for navigating those waters, that when this hit and everything shut down, I was like, I like finally know how to be like tired and restful. And so I'm just going to like lean into that for a bit. Not that I wasn't grieving and feeling the sadness, but as far as like the need to have something to show for myself, I felt like I had worked through that part of my trauma earlier. So I was thankful for that.
I think that idea of perfectionism as it is tied to self-motivation is so complicated, because on one hand, you feel like, I am the person who is going to hold myself responsible for how much I get done or how far I excel in my career. But I think what ends up happening is that we push ourselves so beyond what is realistic or reasonable, and our expectations for ourselves become so outsized that it's hard to sort of distinguish between the sort of perfectionism and the self-motivation. And I'm just,
yes.
Do you feel like that was something, have you always been that way? Like, were you always a perfectionist?
You know, I guess it's so funny. My therapist was the first person to call me a perfectionist. I'm that person. I'm going to talk about my therapist all the time on this.
Sames.
We're being vulnerable.
Sames.
But I remember when she called me a perfectionist, I was like, what do you mean? If I were a perfectionist, I would be perfect and I'd have my life together and I'd be like running marathons and my place would be clean and I'd be like volunteering all the time. And she was like, only a perfectionist thinks that way. So it was revealed to me that I was approaching my life in that manner.
And did you feel like your family was there a sense of high expectations in your household?
Yes. Yes. I had great parents, but I think that also when you're raising Black kids, and my parents were the first in so many ways for their families, that it's like the concept of Black excellence, I think, is something that all of us walk around with, of like, if you have the opportunity to be in a space and to have opportunity, you're always reminded of how many people before you didn't have that opportunity. And so there can be this like honor and burden to excel and to make the most of every single thing and be the best you can possibly be. And I think it can be beautiful in theory, but I do think that when you're young, that messaging can get tricky. Yes. Because what I was faced with when my body no longer wanted to live up to that standard was dealing with the shame of reconciling that I could be human and still be worthy and still be doing my ancestors proud, and reframing what it means to make people proud. And I think also when you are a performer and your gift is in front of people, applause is a tricky thing, you know? It's tricky to like get a sense of success or worth from people being happy with what you're doing. That's like a slippery slope, because I think I also had to learn how to disappoint people, which was something I didn't know how to do, or I didn't know how to be okay with doing.
I feel like there is something to that about a lot of us performers, that we are, the positive feedback loop is so crucial to our being. I have built a life around people basically saying like, you're good at your job. Mm-hmm. And when that is taken away, and it's not even necessarily that people are saying it, but when I go to work on some level, I'm like, I have a sense that I am, I'm doing okay. Mm-hmm. And when that is removed, I don't exactly know what my worth is or who, who I am without the work.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'm so curious I want to answer your question about self-motivation and perfectionism, and then I had a follow-up thought. Also, you and I are in such different positions because you're also a mother, and like there's this whole other layer to your life of wonder, but also I imagine exhaustion that would affect the capacity for self-motivation. It's like keeping a human alive. Like, I don't know what else you need to accomplish in a day. And so that is something that I'm always in awe and like thirsty for knowledge about, because I do hope to have kids one day, and you all are miraculous superhumans to me. And so I'm curious about that for you. But something that's interesting to me about perfectionism and the way my particular type can manifest is that it can also be paralyzing, because I'm a chronic procrastinator, because sometimes self-motivation means doing something that's not going to amount to some grand product. You know, sometimes it's just about reading a chapter because it's going to feel nice, you know? And I think that when you're a perfectionist, like, well, if I'm not going to learn how to play the guitar perfectly today, then why am I going to pick it up at all? And then you're just stuck. And so it doesn't actually lead to motivation in the same way as I think we can think. It can actually keep you stuck, you know?
That makes me think about the noise that I'm constantly managing inside of my head, and how sometimes the way that I talk to myself is helpful because it's motivating and it gets me to do things that I don't want to do. But most of the time, the way that I talk to myself is not helpful. And I think, in fact, contributing to whatever level of either anxiety or exhaustion or self-loathing that I'm struggling with, I similarly was like, I'm not a perfectionist. I think also because I've been in rooms with people who are perfectionists, like particularly in a rehearsal room where people are like, I'm like so mad at myself that I can't get this thing. And I'm not like that.
No, me neither. No.
That I'm like, I'll get it when I get it. But I think what the inner life is obsessive about a sort of how am I measuring myself, not just against, you know, people that I admire, but also against what I just believe I should be doing for myself, and that it's rarely enough. And I think, you know, the like motherhood part of it, I remember that first day at the Gilded Age, I remember you asking me about.
I know, I'm always motherhood. That person. I ask every mother I work with these questions.
It's the greatest. I felt like that was such a generous thing for someone who doesn't have kids to be curious, I think. Mm. Like, because I also feel really aware of being the person that's like, well, I'm a mom and I have a kid, and everybody's like, shut her up. We don't care about this.
No, I feel like all of you should get extra money and a parade and a like personal butler at all times.
Oh my God. Just send that right on over here, please. Around the sort of perfectionism, particularly inside of being a mother, I couldn't, because I love my job so much, and because there were all kinds of parts of motherhood that were so uncomfortable or not satisfying, and because there was no positive feedback loop of like either people being like, you're doing an amazing
like, good job, mom.
That I was just like, this, I'm not good at this. And this is very, and I think also when you have gifts, like when you're born with gifts and things sort of come easily, that I'm like, the truth is, I'm just not that used to not being good at things. If I'm not good at them, I'm like, I'm just not really going to pursue
that
anymore.
That's not my calling.
Exactly. I remember my friend Maria was like, anything that was this hard in my life before this, I just gave it up.
Yes.
And that is not an option with motherhood. I think I have felt really starved creatively and been trying to figure out like, okay, so if the structure doesn't exist, then where does your creativity go? Mm. And how have you felt creatively inside of this time?
Yeah, it was interesting. When this first all happened, I had to get off of social media for a bit because I was struck by like the frenzy of everyone to not be able to sit in the stillness of the like epic thing that we were all just facing. Like, you know, just how quickly the virtual concert started happening, how quickly people were like, I'm going to be writing poetry every day. And I was like, oh my God, like, I had compassion for it, but I was like, people don't know how to be still in the fear and in the sadness and like just let this be big. And I think that I let it be big for a while. And I was like, yeah, all I can do today is watch network television and cry. And like, I'm okay with that and holding space for the privilege that I have to do that. And a lot of people still had to get up and go to work and deliver us our packages so that I could sit and cry somewhere, you know. And
yes.
Carrying all of that, I think I had a lot more grace with myself around like, I can't produce anything right now. I don't want to sing a song. I'm sad. You know,
yes.
It's heavy shit's happening.
Yes.
And I think once that kind of started to like lift a little bit, I was struck with how often I only create if I think a product's going to come out of it and how I never like how much I really do love to dance. And how much I really do love to sing. And I started finding these like African dance classes on YouTube and would just like dance for like 20 minutes. And I was surprised at how much it fulfilled my creativity, even though it wasn't a performance, you know, and like just learning a song to sing because I really like the song and not really sharing it with anyone. Mm-hmm. It kind of like zeroed in how much I actually just like the vibration, like that feeling in my body, like how much I just like singing, even if like I'm not gonna write a song for anyone. A cousin of mine gave me that advice. She was like, she's a healer. And she was like, your instrument is a part of who you are and what you do. And just because you don't have it to show anyone doesn't mean you get to stop using it. Like, it's a part of the vibration that makes you feel well. So, like, sing to yourself and put on some music and just, like, dance for yourself and just still do it. And so I'm making myself sound so zen and amazing. Like, I did it, like, 3 times. You know, it's by no means, like, a part of my daily practice. But it felt good, and it was a discovery.
Yes. And I think it's both inspiring, and it also, like, really rings true in a way that I think of, like, the early days of why we sort of were called to this in the first place, and how that experience of, like, what it felt like to sing is so different for me now, that I think it's very easy, particularly in a long run, the rigor that requires is so intense that it does at a certain point become about a sort of muscle and a kind of real work ethic that can sort of steal a little bit of the joy of the actual doing of it.
Yeah, and remembering the ease of it. You know, when you're in that grind, nothing feels easy anymore, you know?
No.
Or second nature. And you know, it was interesting when you asked me to do this podcast, I was also holding space for what it was like for me to know that I at least had a job on the other side of this, you know, to be in the security of privilege that is HBO and the money that they have to be able to say, we're definitely bringing this back. I think I have a lot of, I'm careful to speak to certainly about the way one should cope through something like this, because I imagine I would feel very differently if I were about to make my Broadway debut and this happened with Great Comet and, like, I had no clue. You know, I think it's a different, we're all orienting to this situation. It'd be different if I didn't have representation and I had just moved to the city or I was in the city. And it's such a personal thing, I think, what everyone's going through and being mindful of. Just the different privileges that we all have in our knapsack that have made this moment feel certain ways. You know what I mean?
Yes. And I think not being able to share in a really connected way the sort of struggles and the sameness of what we're all going through because of the isolation and because it's, you know, it's important for us to stay away from one another, I do think it makes it feel, it's easy to sort of just to feel like you're living in a vacuum and that you don't that you don't have context for how other people are really navigating this time.
Yes. And I think it's interesting because I feel like at the beginning of this, I'm like, I can be such a big picture person and Scorpio moon where I just sort of felt the cataclysmic nature of the world. Mm-hmm. And the idea, like, I remember my agents were being great and they were like sending us like movies to watch to like stay engaged. And I was like, who cares? Like, do you guys know what's going on? Everyone just lay down and like be with it. And it took me a bit. And it took Carl a bit to like, you know, he started putting things on tape again recently to like orient ourselves to investing in something again that felt so small in comparison to what was happening in the world and regrounding ourselves in the fact that what we do does still have meaning. You know what I mean?
Yes. I feel like that has been something, my sort of relationship to being an actor, while I love it more than anything, I think there has also been a little part of me that is like a little embarrassed that is my job. And I don't even really know what that's about, but I will tell you what a global pandemic will do is heal you of that embarrassment, where I was like, I feel like the arts right now, the repair that is sort of required only feels possible through something like theater.
I think
it was interesting. I was in that kind of like way too big picture place. And then I watched Passing Strange on, I just rented it online and it reignited everything in me. I was like, oh my God, I love this so much. I love musical theater. I love singing my feelings. I love that people do this. And it's so incredible. And it's a like a gift. And when everything comes back, I'm seeing everything every night and going dancing every night. And, you know.
Yes. And that's like one of those musicals I will similarly just like it's I will put it on and just listen to a musical because it is.
It was so, so moving special. And powerful. Ugh. And there's this line of, you know, he realizes with his mom that he kept pushing her away because he thought that you couldn't have love without understanding. Hmm. And I was like, isn't that all family relationships as you grow? Like learning that you can love someone without understanding them and be loved without being understood is such like a maturation process. I think one thing that I am thankful for about this pandemic is that for a blip in time, we were faced with what we see when the like, please make more money capitalist machine just pauses for a second. And I think the way it aligned with the racial justice uprisings and the way it forced shows and producers that we've all been a part of, you know, even our own show, to change and to like stop the machine long enough so that convenience is no longer an excuse for your racism and no longer an excuse for your white supremacy in your systems and in your structures. You know, there's always an excuse of, well, there's not time to address this or there's not time to find the right person or cast the right person or find the right thing. And everything being shut down was like, well, that's not an excuse anymore. And you actually have time to look at it. And I don't know that that would have ever happened in the same way if the world was still spinning and we all had to get on the train and answer emails, you know?
It makes me wonder if once we're back up and running, how willing we're going to be to do the work of making our spaces less racist and who we're going to look to help us do that work. I feel like after the election, I heard a lot of activists and media figures saying, we need to look to Black women. We need to follow them and take their lead because they have consistently showed up and they understood the country better than we did and fought for what was right. And I guess I'm just curious how it feels to be both discriminated against and undervalued by society and then also expected to lead us out of this darkness.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think my relationship to that concept has been really interesting about, you know, Black women as caretakers. And I look in my own generational line of the Black women who were, you know, saddled with saving and saving the family and saving situations and working harder than anyone should ever have to work. And I think what's interesting for me, a lot of the stuff that came up around the elections about like Black women saving everyone was that we were doing this out of like martyrdom or the goodness of our hearts and not out of our own self-interest as well. Like we have had to learn how to be so emotionally intelligent and strategically adept and masters of creation because we were given nothing. And so you learn how to be masterful from that. And it was out of our, you know, our own, you know, there's in a Black feminist spaces, it's if you liberate Black women and you liberate Black femme people and you liberate Black queer people, you liberate everyone because the access to freedom from that space, it's the trickle up, you know what I mean? Instead of the opposite. And I think, but something for me that all ties back into these concepts of self-motivation and productivity and perfectionism is like, a couple years ago when I was dealing with my own health issues in contrast to these high standards for myself, I came upon the Knapp Ministry, which is this, it's a space for everyone, but it focuses on Black folks. And I really hear it for Black women about rest as reparations. And our obsession with productivity is so tied to the fact that as Black people in this country, for hundreds of years, we were only worth what we could produce on the cotton field, what we could produce for whoever was profiting off of our beings. And that, like, participating in that kind of self-abuse and grind culture is so tied to white supremacy. And, you know, sometimes she'll have this prompt, like, take a nap for one of your ancestors today who never got to take a nap. And, like, it was so healing for me to think that when I was sitting down to heal, that I was actually still making my ancestors proud versus, like, they're, you know, it's only proud if I can carry the world on my shoulders and make it to the top of the mountain and get a gold star is, like, actually a toxic tool of the system that we're all a part of. But, like, rewiring that part of my brain that's like, no, I actually bless them by healing and resting and thriving and being well, I think was something for me that when the uprisings were happening and I was asked to speak on panels and every white person ever was like, what do we do? I was like, you know, it's not my job to save you. And I've spent a lot of my life being the, like, handholder for people. And I was surprised and thankfully surprised at how brittle my patience was this summer. And it felt like I was finally valuing myself over the codependency of other people's needs, and that it was like, Black women have done enough. And if you feel so called to continue to engage, like, by all means, but if you don't, then, like, sit down and, you know, let the world crumble around you or take care of yourself. And by taking care of yourself, you have to take care of the world. You know what I mean? I've had incredible teachers. There are so many Black feminist women who have been doing this work for so long and finding this language. And I am just so thankful that I found them at the time that I did. It felt like a gift from the universe that at a time where, I mean, when I was just so used to being the person who showed up and made everyone proud and showed up and did perfectly and, like, did exactly what I was called to do. And when my body started falling apart, I, like, couldn't be that person. It, like, made my circuits fire. My brain was like, what do you mean? What do you mean I have to, like, call out halfway through the show because, you know, I'm blind in one eye because of my migraine? Like, this isn't me. I'm not the person who has to do stuff like this. And looking at my shame with that, looking at, like, my ableism with the concept of not being allowed to be ill, I think that those spaces are what made me kind of find my way through that and not just, like, self-destruct, you know? And so I feel like I benefited from the work that so many of these teachers have done to connect those dots. You know, they connected the dots of rest to the kind of generational trauma of productivity for me as a Black woman. And what I watched my grandmothers do and my own mother do and drive their own bodies into the ground for the sake of other people's survival, you know?
Yes. Do you feel like you'll be able to, I guess it's like a, this is sort of two part, like, do you feel like there is a couple of lessons in this past year that you're like, I really want to bring that into this life post pandemic, or even just what you hope it will look like on the other side, more for yourself than
than for the world. It's so interesting. I feel like it's been such, like, a long form of growth that in this year you could not face yourself, you know? But yeah, it's such an interesting question. I think something that I did learn, even with the Gilded Age, with other things, like, it's always worth it to write the letter. It's always worth it to be who you are in the space. And I think there can be this concept of, like, well, you play the game and then you get in the room and then you, like, slowly reveal what you care about over time. after they can't fire you, you know? And I feel like I learned that, like, it is worth it to have people know who you are right away and know what you care about and know the standard that you are going to try to hold yourself to and your character to respectfully, especially in regards to, like, I really believe in the power of storytelling. I believe that we have as much power of shaping history as our history books. Like, we create the culture of what people think happened in the world. And it is an incredible responsibility. And so I think that I developed the courage to push people and to not treat it like it's not a big deal, because I'm like, what Peggy does on screen does affect what we believe about that moment in history and what we believe about our relationships to each other and what we believe about anti-blackness or black liberation. Like, it is also connected to me. And so I think I felt affirmed in walking in my own power. And I hope that I continue with that through this season, you know, as everyone's Instagram feeds go back to whatever they care about, that, like, it was a lesson in it's worth it to take care of myself and I don't need to save anyone, but there are some things that will keep me up at night and that I'm a person who just has to say what I'm thinking and feeling. And I think I resisted that part of myself a little bit this year and was like, okay, you don't have to be that person all the time. And I was like, nope, I'm that person.
That's just who you are.
It just is what it is.
I think that's so amazing to hear you say that, because I think genuinely at that first Broadway Advocacy Coalition concert, or like you sang the last song and you came on stage and I was like, that 22-year-old or however old you were, I was like, she knows who she is. Like, there was something about you that just felt way beyond a sort of young star making her Broadway debut, that I just think it's funny to think that a sort of outside perception of us can be maybe a little bit fragmented with our own perception of ourselves. And that I think that has been something with all of this time to sort of say, like, even if it was what you were projecting, if you don't feel it inside, it doesn't matter. And so, like, kind of merging those two selves, I think, makes all of us so much luckier, because you are such a really powerful and special human being. And so I'm really grateful to you for sitting down today and having this talk.
I feel like I didn't ask you enough questions.
Oh my God, you're crazy?
Hosting this, so
yes, that's
people
right.
will hear it from you and
plenty,
know you.
Plenty. Since I spoke with Danae last week, I cannot stop thinking about this idea of owning your power and also steering yourself away from perfectionism. I feel like she really made me think about the expectations that I set for myself. And when I think about the fact that we both had a sort of physical and mental unraveling during the runs of our Broadway shows, I have started to believe this, that if I could have just accepted where I was instead of constantly punishing myself, I would have been so much less exhausted. And I feel like if I had had a conversation with her while she was struggling during her shows, I would have had so much compassion and understanding for what she was going through. And I guess this just makes me feel like the next time that I'm really struggling, it might be helpful to talk to myself the way that I would talk to someone that I love or respect. I hope some of this resonated and that you'll carry it with you, especially when you're struggling. It feels like if we can learn how to take better care of ourselves, then we'll have a greater capacity to take care of others, and maybe even have some energy left over to stand up for what is right and just. I want to leave you with a little weekly roundup of things that this conversation made me think about. I'll do this every week. Some of them are related to our talk, and some are just things that I think you should know about. So the first is a book called Burnout, The Secret to Unlocking the Stress Cycle. It's by Emily and Amelia Nagoski. They're sisters. And the book really explores why rest and human connection and how making peace with your inner critic are keys to recovering and preventing burnout. The next is an episode from the Post Reports podcast called The Life of George Floyd. It's a really thoroughly and beautifully researched piece of journalism that looks at George Floyd not so much as the symbol that he's become, but as the man himself. It interviews his family. It talks about his ambition, his flaws, and the systematic racism that he experienced throughout his life. And finally, there's an article in Vogue called On Stacey Abrams and the Persistent Problem of Leaning Too Heavily on Black Women. It's by Rachel Charlene Lewis, who's a Black queer writer, and she really interrogates this fine line between celebrating Black women's efforts and burdening them with the responsibility to save us. You should also obviously check out Passing Strange and the Knapp Ministry, which we referenced in the episode. You can find links to all of these in our show notes. I hope this conversation was as helpful to you as it was to me. I cannot wait for the next episode. And in the meantime, take care of yourselves. This week's episode was recorded in New York on the lands of the Mohican and Lenape people. Sunday Pancakes is produced by Rachel Sussman of Plate Spinner Productions, with editing and engineering by Tim Kashani and Ali Rice of Apples and Oranges Arts. The theme music is by Gavin Creel. Special thanks this week to John Conley, Susan Blackwell, and Andrew Keenan-Bolger. Sunday Pancakes is distributed by Playbill.